Hello and welcome to Blogosphere, Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley and I'm the founder of Blogosphere. We run events, a magazine, an influencer network, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, please do drop me an email at alice@blogosphere.com. We're delighted to announce that Series 3 of Serious Influence has an exclusive sponsor, the music licensing platform, Licked. Licked provide commercial music from real labels for licensing into creators' content. It means that you can have great music on your videos without the fear of copyright claims or losing ad revenue. If you want to learn more about how you can legally use the music you love, be sure to check out Licked's website, licked.co. That's L-I-C-K-D.co. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by influencer Lorna Lux. This interview was recorded live at the Blogosphere Festival, and we are delighted to announce that Lorna is our issue 22 cover star. You can order now from blogosphere.magazine.com. The imagery is amazing, and if you manage to get one, please do take a flat lay and tag us.
I am Lorna. I have an Instagram account called Lorna Lux. I did have a blog, but I don't really do anything with that now. And I've got my own collection within the style as well, so I'm a bit of a jack of all trades at the minute.
It has been a bit of a phenomenal year for In The Style. This is a business podcast, so some of the stats around your summer collection, £64,000 in an hour, £300,000 in a week. How does that make you feel?
Yeah, a bit overwhelmed, actually. Didn't expect it. I don't think you ever really do, because the nature of our industry is still quite emerging, isn't it? So we're all kind of finding our feet. So although we can kind of guess how well something's going to be received, you don't really know. I was nervous. I was very nervous before that launch.
Let's take it back a bit to the beginning, though. We'll go into more of the business bit later. Tell me about your kind of background, your professional life, where you grew up. What were you like as a child, Lorna?
Yeah, I was quite a confident kid. And I just had quite a normal upbringing. My mum brought me up. I live with my nana and granddad as well, so I had quite a nice family unit. And then I went to uni when I was just turned 18, and I was going to be a classical pianist. And I always tell this story, so I'll just quickly tell it again. But basically, after about a year of doing it at uni, my tutor said, "Oh, your hands aren't big enough. So you know you're never going to get a job doing this. You're never going to be really good at it." And I was like, oh. So I changed my degree. I ended up doing English as well, which I was always quite good at. So it was fine. I didn't mind doing that.
Do you think that helped with when you got into blogging?
No, it didn't. I kind of blagged my way through uni. I wasn't really interested. I got a job at Dixon's. I used to sell TVs and loved it. I loved selling. And I realised then that I loved customer service. So I always thought whatever job I end up doing, it'll be quite customer related or something where I could have actual contact with a person that was buying something. And then I didn't want to go home after uni, and my mum said, "Look, I'm really sorry, but I can't afford to sustain your lifestyle up in Newcastle."
What was your lifestyle like growing up?
Well, it was just very boozy. I wasn't really doing anything. I wasn't creative. There was no Instagram back then, so I didn't have social media. I think Facebook existed, maybe.
But would you say you came from an affluent background or...?
No, we were really skint. And because it was just my mum and she was bringing me up on her own, we didn't really have much money. I'm just not that fussed about having lots of money, as long as I can do things. I'm more about experience than I'm about products, which is crazy when you think what I do now, which fundamentally from the outside in probably looks like quite a kind of shallow existence, if you like, of what I'm wearing each day and what I've bought and whatnot.
Well, I suppose it's a highlight reel.
Yeah, of course. And actually, the reality is quite the opposite. For me, the fun bit is sitting in a bar with my husband or seeing my mates or, just the basic stuff.
So you graduate from uni, you're working in Dixon's, doing some sales. Then where does your career take you?
Well, I didn't want to go home. And on the back of Cosmo magazine was an ad for Virgin Atlantic. They wanted cabin crew. And I was like, I can do this. This is me. So I applied and I got in. And then I moved. I had to move to Gatwick to do my training.
And how long were you with Virgin Atlantic? And do you think that was a good training ground?
Yeah, Years. They couldn't get rid of me. I was there maybe like 8 years, mm-hmm. and I loved it. It was like the best job I've ever had. In fact, if I could redo my 20s again, I would do the same job. I loved it. I really enjoyed it. A lot of travel, just seeing the world.
And I suppose meeting lots of different types of people and being able to communicate on lots of different levels.
Yeah, yeah, and different people and just different cultures, because I'd not really travelled. Like, my holidays as a kid were like Blackpool or just normal kids' holidays, but this was another world. And I also, it's the first time I realised how rich some people were, because I'd been brought up on a normal little council estate in Sale. I just never realised that people lived this lifestyle and didn't think about what they were buying and wearing and whatnot, and that fascinated me a little bit.
Fascinated, but was it something that at that time you wanted to emulate, or would you say, because now you obviously do have a sort of luxury feed?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I was impressionable. I really liked it. I wanted to know how they'd got where they got, and I really wanted to be there myself, if I was honest. And I definitely, in my 20s, I always say this phrase, but I lived a champagne lifestyle, but I was on £800 a month. It was a very lemonade wage. Like, we had no money, and I lived with two other girls in a house in Brighton, and we would steal toilet rolls from bars because we literally had no money. And I loved it. We had a great time. But in our heads, we were like these air hostesses on the advert, and we would strut through the airport swishing our ponytails, and it was just funny.
So you were there for 8 years.
Yeah.
And then is that when you branched into the world of social media?
No, it wasn't actually. So I left Virgin. I was quite poorly. I'm quite open about it. I was anorexic. I was pretty bulimic for most of my 20s. And I hid it very well. And then I was kind of struck by anorexia, and it really crippled me. It made me into a bit of a shell of what I am at the minute. And I got very poorly, and Virgin were like, look, we're going to support you. We will pay for you not to work, but at some point, you're going to have to make a decision. And I got grounded. I didn't really want to work on the desks, because I always in my head was like, no, I'm a big air hostess. Like, I'm a glamorous globetrotter. I can't work at Gatwick Airport. So psychologically, it hit me really hard, actually, and I had to kind of give up. So I didn't work for, I think I had about a year and a half off, courtesy of Mr. Lux. He funded that. And thank God he did, actually, because that's how I got well. So I had that time off to kind of get my mental health back together.
And was that the time then that you started social media? And which was the platform that you started first?
I started on Instagram. And the plan was that I was going to do an Instagram a day, and it would be a mirror selfie, and it'd just be a, this is what I was wearing today, and to check up on myself to make sure I wasn't going any skinnier. But also, I loved fashion. And what I quickly found on Instagram was that there was lots of people from all over the world that had the same interests as me. Whereas where I was living in Horsham at this time, I didn't really meet anyone like me that cared about a Celine trapeze bag or I don't know, whatever else it was I wanted. So I kind of picked up a bit of a hobby. Because I wasn't really eating, I wouldn't go out at night, so I didn't really have a social life. And I would sit there for hours at night chatting to people. And this is back in the day when Instagram would reward people for engagement. And so at the time, there was a thing that Instagram did, and it was called the suggested users page. And basically, they only followed 200 people, and they would change that list every 2 to 3 weeks. And I got put on this list, and because when you subscribe to Instagram, you have to follow, I don't know, 5 accounts. All of a sudden, I had all these random people from, like, Uzbekistan following me. And I grew from about, I think I had 7,000 on the Thursday, and 2 weeks later, I had 70,000.
Oh, my God.
And it was a bit like, whoa, because then I started getting invited to things, and it was very bizarre because I just wasn't really cut out for the world I was about to join.
So you'd sort of not been going out for about a year and
never went anywhere.
Yeah.
It was bizarre. So I didn't actually go to a lot of events to start with because I was a bit nervous. Because I'd grown so rapidly, there's a bit of a distrust element because people were like, well, who's she? Don't remember seeing her last year. Why has she got so many followers? So I kind of had to learn my craft, if you like. And then that was when I decided I'm going to start a blog and I'm going to do this properly. And I'm going to earn my right to kind of be in the room. And that's what happened.
Did you become obsessed with the platform, like, quite quickly? Obviously, you were using it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've got quite an obsessive personality. Addictive, if you like. So this became my new addiction. And it was very distracting for me because it meant that for the first time, I wasn't thinking about my weight because I'd found a new thing to do. So my family really encouraged it. My friends did at the time as well. And, yeah, I'd say that it's still quite an addictive... Social media is very addictive, isn't it?
Would you say that you have a healthy relationship with social media now?
Absolutely not.
Lorna, do you want to tell the crowd what your daily screen time is?
I think we agreed it was like 16 hours or something, wasn't it? Yes. But to be fair, I've had a lot going on this week.
Okay, so you've joined, you're starting to be invited to events. Is this through PRs or is this not marketing people at this stage?
Do you know what? There was about three or four people that latched onto me pretty quickly and they've stuck with me till today. And they're probably people I still speak to now that were just really good at their jobs, that were just spotting people, that were creating content different to what other people were doing. And they kind of kept me under their wing. And as they moved to different PR companies and marketeers and stuff, I just kind of followed them. And actually, you need those people at the beginning of your career because they kind of guide you and they give you a bit of knowledge about who's earning what. And I was naive. I didn't have a clue. I just thought getting free stuff was a great thing to have. I never realised how much of a business it could be.
Did you get that just from the PRs and marketers, or was that also from contemporary influencers?
Yeah, I definitely started to go to more events and chat. Yeah. And actually, a lot of the people I'm still good mates with from back in the day, I still speak to now. It's not really changed.
What sort of year is it then that you start going out to the events?
I'd say 2016 was like my year where John was like, are you coming home tonight? I was going out a lot. And I was like, I'm building up my Instagram. But actually, it's a half and half, isn't it? Because as content creators, most of our work is done when we're not out and about. It's done in the privacy of our own homes or with our partners or our person that helps us create pictures. So it's quite a weird job, isn't it? Because you have to be quite social to get known, but then you have to be quite boring to get the job done.
How integral is Mr. Lux to Team Lux?
Massive.
Yeah. I think what is that dynamic? Like creator, analytical, both do the same?
Yeah, not... He will hate me for saying this. Where is he? He's over there. I don't think he's necessarily the creative in the relationship. I'm a big art director. It's not unlike for me to make him stand there and I'll set the scene and then he will switch. But certainly some of the best pictures on my Instagram, he directed it and took it. It's a bit of fluke, isn't it? And because we love each other so much, he catches me in ways that maybe a professional photographer wouldn't. He'll just catch that moment that maybe, you know, no one else would have got. And that comes through the page. People can see that when we're shooting together, it's real life. Like, we don't really create scenarios. We just kind of shoot our way through the day. I shoot every day, by the way. Even if I don't post it on Instagram, every single day I'm taking photos of my outfit. Because you just never know when that picture might work or that moment. I mean, I'm not annoying about it, am I? A bit, maybe. But I do think it's nice to have that consistent kind of storytelling, whatever I'm doing, even here.
And you mentioned that you had that year and a half and luckily he was able to support you.
Yeah.
Kind of touched upon it before, but do you think that on the whole, the majority of influencers that you do meet come from comfortable beginnings and that it is,
I'm going to quote
from the interview, a posh person's game.
Yeah, it is a posh person's game. I mean, what I realised very quickly was that on Instagram specifically, expensive items trend, they get more likes, people like good stuff. So if you can afford to go out and buy all this gear, you're naturally going to get more airtime and more exposure. And I do think that, you know, I said this to you the other day, I think about 90% of the people I meet doing the job I'm doing at the minute on the trips that I go on, the events I get invited to, are rich girls that have got a lot of money that probably don't really need to do this. And this is just their, like, hobby. And they won't mind me saying that. And I don't mean any offence by it. But what I would like to see is some kind of part of our income be channeled into something that could maybe fund for creatives coming through the ranks to create that kind of level of content. Because not everyone can afford a Leica camera, can afford to take 3 days off work, to go on a press trip to Clevedon. It's all these little things that people maybe don't think about. They add such weight to your brand progression. I've been able to do it because John, you know, bless him, has worked hard and has contributed massively to me in terms of financially.
In terms of brand deals that have happened and, you know, we want to be able to support everyone, what was the first paid for bit of content that you did?
Do you know, I don't think I could tell you. I think my first ever freebie was a triangle bikini. I remember that.
Do you feel that you've ever been taken advantage of by brands?
I think that post the event I have, yeah. I had an experience that I'd shared with you, which was that I'd done some work for a jewellery brand. And at the time, the edit that I had on my Instagram was quite unique to me. It was just something that not a lot of people were doing. So it made my images quite recognisable. And this girl texted me and she was like, do you know what, Lorna? I swear your hand's on the back of Stylist magazine. So I looked at the Stylist magazine and it was an old picture I'd posted on my Instagram. And this brand had kind of worked with me on that project. But what I hadn't realised was that when I'd been paid, you know, my 200 quid for the hand shot, that what I'd actually not been paid for was the rights to this image that was now in a global campaign. That was a bit annoying.
Did being paid coincide with you getting management, or were you doing brand deals prior to having management?
Yeah, I mean, I only got management about a year and a half ago.
What was the process for getting management, and what would your advice be to people that are seeking management?
Well, initially, I'd not really wanted it. I'm quite a control freak by nature, so I didn't really fancy the idea of anyone else being involved, especially my inbox. That whole idea of handing over my emails, I was like, I'm not really feeling this. And then I'd done a trip in LA with Revolve, and I ended up sat at this table with this lady. I was meant to be sat next to Sincerely Jules, and I was very disappointed because when we all sat down, Sincerely Jules wasn't there, and this woman was sat next to me, and I didn't recognise her. And I was like, who are you? And she was like, oh, I'm Jules's manager. So I was like, okay, that's interesting. So we started chatting, and she managed loads of big bloggers, We Wore What, Brian Boy, loads of great people. And we were talking, and she was like, you've done really well to get here, like, you know, because they don't really invite any old person. I was like, I know, yeah, we're really having a good time. I said, oh, I'd quite like management. And she was like, well, don't get management until you can afford it and you really need it. And I think the biggest learning process for me, both in having management and working with them, is that the initial hit was actually, they're not going to bring in these big brand deals overnight, that I need to be able to afford to lose 20% of my income for the next 6 months. Well, we as a team work out where we're going to take me, what I want to do, what I'm not good at, what I'm great at. And I think a lot of people that I've spoken to, a lot of my peers anyway, kind of get itchy feet in that first 6 months because they go, I've not got any more work, but I've spent a bit more money this year.
What do you think the most positives about having management? Is it like contracts, holding you to account?
Yeah. Contracts, protection, confidence. My management are Wayla over there. Formidable. They are thorough. Nothing gets left to chance. They'll tell me if I've done something wrong. They hold me accountable for everything that I do. They point out my mistakes. They make me aware when I've done something great, which is nice. And we just kind of work as a collaboration as opposed to it being them telling me what to do or me wielding the big stick. It's not like that relationship at all.
What is the feedback loop like? Because I know that some people want feedback direct from the brands.
Yeah.
And then, you know, do you feel sometimes you feel that you do get told when people are not happy?
Nobody's ever said anything bad about Wayla to me.
No, not Wayla, you.
I don't know. I don't think they would tell me.
Really? Would you like to know?
Yeah, I would actually.
Okay.
But I don't think that me as a person, I'm quite a normal person. So the only time I'm going to drop the ball is with the content itself. So that is definitely, if we ever
have
an issue.
As in posting it on top.
Yeah, like if I've created a picture and they're like, no, we don't really want to see Lorna in a fluffy coat. We wanted this. So I think the learning curve for us as a management team is before I ever create content now, we sit down and go, well, hang on, are they going to be all right with me wearing another fluffy coat on the ground? You know, we do all that first. It's all about the crazy thing is about this industry is that a lot of what we do that is successful looks very of the moment, and it just happened, like, you know, she's just shopping now and look, she looks great in that nice coat. But actually, it's weeks sometimes of pre-planning that I know I need to get purple into my feed in September, and I've started in June feeding that colour into my grid. It's those things that maybe don't go seen, and that's what brands are paying for. They're paying for your effort and your creative vision, not just your community. And that's the joy of it, isn't it? We become about 10 different jobs, don't we? We're the art director, the writer, the creator, photographer. It's a crazy entrepreneurial journey we're all on.
And being a personal brand as well, so you've got to.
Yeah, which is mental to think that, because as far as I'm concerned, I'm just still Lorna. And it's lovely when you get to look at your brand from afar and go, oh, that's like, you know, I've created all that. I can't imagine anyone in this room doesn't look at their Instagram sometimes and just go, oh, I really like my feed at the minute. Like, you know, it looks really good. It's quite a proud moment because there's so much effort involved and there's no shame in that. You've got to big yourself up.
Do you also, though, on the back of that, feel that there is quite a lot of pressure? And would you say that the pressure comes from, you know, you want to please your audience, but is that kind of you putting it on yourself?
again, I think this goes back to money and about ad space and about the pressures come from the ads. The pressures, if I don't have any work for a month and all I have to do is get up and get dressed and post a cute picture, I am living my best life. My Instagram looks hot. I didn't have to do anything I didn't want to, and that is the happy spot for me. And I think as my brand or business has grown, my management are very aware of the fact that I want to do less ads, not more. To me, success is about me being in control. I think that's probably part of my illness and my lifestyle and whatnot. And I think that certainly micro-influencers that maybe are at a point in their career where they want to kind of maybe work part-time or effectively do this full-time, it's really important that they can pay their rent and pay their bills and whatnot. And of course, you've got to take on those ads. And how do you navigate between the ones that you really shouldn't have done? Because we've all done them. And I look back now and I'm like, oh no, why did I advertise that? And I think that's a big financial pressure that, like I say, the people that kind of grow like that can afford to, because they didn't take on the ad for the toothpaste or whatever. They were too busy buying Chanel bags, living their best life on Bond Street. And this is the big, I don't know, I struggle with it a little bit.
What is it about a brand campaign when that comes through to you that makes you say, yes, this is what I want?
Are they going to align with my brand? Would it make sense? You know, if I've been driving a Volvo for a whole year and then Aston Martin want to pay me for a campaign, that's probably not going to work for me at this moment. Are they going to amplify my brand? So often I'm looking for brands that are maybe a little bit more luxury than me, that are going to make sure that in the future other brands want to work with me. And also, do I really like the stuff? So it's much easier with fashion because most shops do something you like. Whereas when you get into specific things like skincare or beauty products, I remember once, I think there was a campaign, it was doing the rounds, quite a few people were doing it for a very expensive skincare brand, and I was quite tempted to like push Whaler actually to kind of reach out and see if there was any money left for me. But then I was thinking, but am my audience going to spend 600 quid on a moisturiser? And they're probably not. And I think you just have to be realistic. Would you buy it? Would you wear it if it wasn't a freebie? And they're kind of my guides, really. I haven't really deviated from that.
How well would you say that you know your audience? Because you're obviously over 900,000 now.
It's
getting close to that million.
Oh, I can't. Do you know, it's just been such... In my head, I still have 7,000 followers. I reply to all my messages. If I don't reply, there's only three reasons I won't reply to you. You're trying to sell something to me. It's something offensive. Or we're related. Anyone else that messages me, you will at some point get a reply. But I think that's key for brand and building your business. Because if I don't know what the people that are following me like or don't like, how am I going to progress? I'm just going to stay stuck in a rut, I think.
But do you not think there's going to become a point where you literally physically cannot do that?
Never.
What's your email account like? Is that zero, inbox zero?
I don't give out my email address. Whaler manage my inbox. So my actual inbox is just, you know, all the discount deals and like Net-a-Porter are relentless. In the style, I get three In the Style emails a day.
That's a good segue, actually, because I want to ask you, In the Style, obviously, we began with that and your sellout summer collection. You crashed the website last week.
Yeah, I know. I was quite annoyed about that, I'm not going to lie.
So how did that collaboration come about?
Came about over a year ago now, and Adam, the founder, contacted Whaler and put all the idea together. I thought they were taking the mic. I'm very open about this. I was like, no.
So he spotted you?
Well, funnily enough, he says he spotted me, but then the first meeting I ever had with him, he actually admitted that he'd never heard who I was. And he was like, oh, it was all the other girls in the office. And I think one of the reasons that we ended up collaborating was because a lot of the other, a few of the creators that he'd worked with had pulled my Instagram images for their mood boards. And he was kind of like, let's work with this person if they like her style. So that was nice.
Because you mood board every day as well.
Yeah, I do, yeah. But I think mood boarding for me is like therapy, just to kind of take me away from everything, and I'll go to Tumblr, Instagram, Pinterest, quite often not pages that I normally follow in day-to-day life. And I just pull together little mood boards, and then every now and then I'll put them on my stories to kind of share what I'm doing.
So he comes to Whaler,
yeah.
You sit down, you decide that you're going to do it. So how involved? And of course it was filmed for the BBC documentary Breaking Fashion as well.
Yeah, I mean, they came in very late to the game for me, because when they started filming that, I'd already designed my second collection and we were about to market it. So really it was a shame for me actually, because the best bit of the collection, I think, is the first bit when you're designing. And I work with two people there, predominantly a girl called Lorien. And Lorien has a vision that is very aligned to mine, and we message most days, unfortunately for her. And we just share images all the time. She gets my mood boards, she gets what I'm about. So when we're putting together a collection, there's a lot of sketching involved. There's a lot of make the sleeves bigger, let's make this waist, let's try this neckline. And we just kind of, we end up creating about 100 pieces for each collection, and that gets whittled down to about 30. But actually they will sample up to 100 pieces. And then we, you know, I have to try them all on and tear them apart and all that. But it's quite intense.
Would you say that you are quite hard on, I don't like this? And...
Yeah, I am, yeah. I'm a bit obsessed. But I take it very personally, because I always thought if it's my collection, imagine if I put a collection out and then everyone's like, oh, that, she doesn't wear that. I'd be mortified. So from my head, I was just like, I've got to design something completely true to me. I can't dupe anyone that I'm working with. That's the hardest bit. Because you get so obsessed with styles and shapes that you love wearing that when you come to design your own stuff, you're like, oh, but that does look a bit like this. So a lot of my design process with Lorien is being thorough and making sure that we're not ripping off someone else. And actually, the porcelain print, we didn't have it copyrighted, but when we designed that print, it was inspired by like China plates and Lisbon tiles, and we created something that's unique to us. We own that print. But to see the amount of brands that have kind of adopted it and taken it through the entire kind of fast fashion world.
How does that make you feel?
Kind of quite proud in a way, because we were there first and I loved that dress that we designed. I loved that collection. I'm really proud of it. I think that actually will carry on till next season. I think it's a great print.
You talked about mood boarding and going to other areas outside of kind of the normal social media.
Yeah.
How do you balance comparison online and staying creative?
I think comparison's a massive problem for pretty much everyone, isn't it? I don't suffer from it, if I'm honest. I quite like being me. I'm not that bothered about what other people are doing. I think my problems and my demons come from me not being enough, me not being a good enough wife, not being clever enough, not being this, that and the other. So my competition is very internal, and I think that's just something I'll have to work through my life, basically. But I don't really look at other influencers or other creators and go, oh, I want what they've got. But I get very excited when I see someone doing something different. And through the course of the last, 5 years, every now and then you spot a new influencer, you're like, oh my God, like this person's like absolutely smashing it. And there's one a year usually, and it's just a really nice thing to see.
Do you normally share them on your...
Yeah, I'll put them on stories. I've got an Instagram account called Street Style Looks, which is about sharing other people's street style and outfits that I like. Yeah, I'll just kind of champion them, if you like. And sometimes I invite them to stuff and they're like, I don't even know who you are. But I'm like, really excited. And I get like giddy about it. But I think that's a personal... I just really like clothes.
You said earlier that you can take things like personally about the collection. Would you say in terms of social media platforms that there's a particular one which is more difficult, and what are your policies on sort of...
I know where you're going with it.
Trolling.
I'm just not very good at Twitter. I struggle with it. I'm not very good at saying something back to someone in 140 or 240 words. I really struggle with it.
280?
Is it 280? I thought about coming off Twitter, actually, because I found it a bit negative. And when I was going on Twitter, it was either people sharing news-related things, which is never fun to read, or it was kind of people complaining. Even I was doing it. You know, like if I'd had bad service, you know, my EasyJet flight was delayed an hour. I found myself tweeting about it. I don't know, I might have a bit of a love-hate relationship with it, because I do think you get a true personality perspective of someone if you follow them on all their social medias. So if I'm a bit of a fan, I like to follow them on everything so I can kind of keep an eye on like what they're really like. And I think if I didn't follow them on Twitter, I would lose a bit of that. So the only thing really keeping me there is my voyeurism of other influencers and other creators, not really for me.
But do you tend then, on the whole, to find that things that are tweeted at you, that's where the negativity lives as opposed to sliding in to your DMs?
Yeah. I mean, I actually I don't know if it's fluke, but I get very little hate on Instagram, touch wood. And if someone sends me a bit of a crappy message, I usually kind of find out, are you all right? Like, you know, you sound a bit pissed off, like, do you want to have a chat? I've got time, I chat to everyone. So I just feel like Instagram's a bit of a happier place to be for me. Whereas I think Twitter is a place to challenge people to, if you've got a cause or if there's something you're passionate about, you're probably going to want to talk about it. And certainly, you know, it's the elephant in the room, we might as well mention it, but with Breaking Fashion, you know, it's a documentary on BBC One. I think some people did feel that as a documentary in such a prime slot on TV, it should have focused more on the negative impact of fashion and climate change and not the positive. And it was kind of like a sugar-coated view of what influencer life is like and what Adam's achieved. Adam, what he's achieved is incredible. And luckily for him, I think he probably did have sign-off on a lot of that that went out. So, of course, it was never going to be a kind of hate campaign against fast fashion.
Do you feel there are some synergies between yourself and Adam, like coming from sort of...
No.
No. Oh.
I like Adam. I think Adam's really great, but Adam's got the ability to do business and not make it personal. I just can't do that. Everything is so personal to me, and I'm not afraid to admit it. And I think that's been my weakness as a creator, but also been a secret kind of weapon. Because it's quite disarming to people when they see a real person as opposed to someone that doesn't give a shit and is just doing it for, you know, whatever. I think there's a real connection, and I don't think I'll ever lose. Hopefully I won't lose that.
In terms of the business side of things, we're seeing an increase in budgets that are coming into the influencer space. We have had sort of the last 2 years, I'd say, is like, Instagram is where the majority of the budgets are going, and prior to that it was YouTube. Do you think that we are going to see the budgets stay on kind of static imagery, or do you think that we'll see more of a shift into video? Are we going to see you on IGTV?
Yes. But I do think that a strong creator, regardless of how you create content, will always earn you a valuable sum. So if you're not comfortable with a video, do not feel like you have to go along with everyone else and create what you're being told to create, because people will always find value in still imagery. It's still a very pleasing thing to observe. And although we're all told we consume more and more video day in, day out, that's all I get told. Management, do this, get on TikTok, do all these videos, you know, start being more fun and loud. The reality is that I, as a consumer, enjoy still imagery. So if I enjoy it, someone else must.
But do you think that your collections would have been as successful if you did an Instagram story as much as you do? Because that is where you do see your personality.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. I think stories is great. It's a great tool because there's not as much edit involved, and you don't feel that pressure that you do on the main grid to create like a shop window, if you like. So you can be more adventurous. And I love that. So I really do enjoy stories. I'd say that my engagement on stories is 20 times higher than my engagement on my main grid, which is very annoying. But actually, a lot of my paid work now is with stories because brands get value from it, and that's great for them and it's great for me. But I think you just have to find your way and what you're comfortable with. And certainly some of the biggest creators that I follow right now, I don't even know what they sound like. They've never spoken. I couldn't even tell you what country they're from. So I do not believe that you have to be a video person to succeed in this industry.
What would you say are your biggest frustrations in the influencer market?
For me, when I go out with John and maybe meet one of his like work friends and they think it's a bit weird that we'll take photographs, I get a bit annoyed because I feel like, oh, like I'm embarrassed. And if we go out for a drink and he'll take like a few pictures and then I'll be like, right, that's it, done now. Like, you know, people are watching. And he's like, no, this is your job. Take it seriously. We need to get the shot. And I think that's my insecurity. And it's just a lack of understanding in the world, if you like, because it's so new, isn't it? People have only been doing this a few years. So when I'm walking down the street and I see someone taking a picture, I'm not thinking, oh my God, they're vain. I'm like, oh, I wonder if I'm following them on Instagram. I wonder what they're doing. Because I'm interested. I always think in my internal monologue is, oh, people are just thinking I'm vain, I'm shallow, I'm and I struggle with that. So I kind of need to get over that.
And finally, what are your predictions for the influencer marketplace in the next sort of year? What are we going to see more of? Or what do you hope we see more of? What do you think we'll see less of?
I think going back to what we've spoken about in the past, what I'm seeing a shift in at the minute is that a lot of brands are taking their marketing and PR in-house. And I don't know if that's because relationships with influencers are very different to print, and we're such creatives that we need a lot more nurturing and a lot more relationship building. And the only way to really get that is to do it in-house, because obviously if you're part of a bigger agency, the person that's schmoozing you for this campaign might take you away. So I think brands are getting very protective over their influencers, and you're going to see those relationships. They're very aligned. You know, it's common knowledge within the influencer space that certain influencers are the favourites of certain brands. And I'm sure I'm a favourite of a couple of brands, but, you know, I'll go to a lunch or whatever and my manager will be like, right, so, you know, what we're thinking, you know, do you want me to write to them? Should we pitch something? And I'm like, no, they've only got budget for this, you know, it's just the way it is. There's a lot to be said about relationships. And my biggest advice to anyone in this room that is doing this job is to never underestimate the power of a relationship with someone that you get on with, because just because they may be not in the job doing the PR of the company that you want to work with now, that doesn't mean that in 2 years' time they're working at the biggest company that you really want to work at. And some of my biggest paid gigs have come from relationships that I started because we were stood outside, she was smoking and I was, you know, with John or whatever. It's those kind of relationships that seem to see you through your career. So that's my advice.
Relationships are key.
A big thanks to Lorna Lux for coming on the show. You've been listening to Blogosphere, Serious Influence, with me, Alice Audley. Join us next week for a brand new episode. Until then, be sure to check out blogosphere.magazine.com for more influencer industry updates. And why not invest in a subscription to our essential magazine whilst you're there?